WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Phil Jackson on coaching this year's NBA champions, the Chicago Bulls. In 1993, Jackson became the first head coach since Red Auerbach to win three consecutive NBA championships. Now he coaches two of basketball's biggest stars, Michael Jordan and Dennis Rodman. Jackson says when he took over the Bulls, he vowed to create an environment based on the principles he'd learned as a Christian and as a student of Zen Buddhism. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new release by Kate and Anna McGarrigle, their first in 6 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. It now appears that a planned Arab-Israeli summit will go ahead as scheduled. President Clinton says he'll participate in the talks. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Early this morning, the White House denied reports that Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat wanted a delay in the talks. White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry said that the president expected Arafat to attend. Moments later, Palestinian officials announced that Arafat would fly to Washington. He is stopping first in Luxembourg this afternoon for talks with European community officials. Then he will travel to the United States. President Clinton invited both Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Arafat to Washington after renewed violence in Israel caused the deaths of 73 people. White House spokesman McCurry says there is still no word on whether Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak will accept the president's invitation to the summit. President Clinton has invested a lot of time and political capital into making the Middle East peace process a success, and the latest events are a setback. If the Washington summit does not produce results, it could tarnish his foreign policy record. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Israeli commanders in the Gaza Strip were quoted today as saying indiscriminate shooting by Jewish settlers and Israeli soldiers touched off the bloodiest day of clashes in the Strip last week. The report in Israel's Haaretz Daily came as Palestinians accused Jewish settlers of shooting at Arabs in the West Bank last week and of harassing Palestinians this week. According to the paper, Israeli Infrastructure Minister Ariel Sharon was told by army commanders during a tour of the area yesterday that shooting by settlers and Israeli soldiers had set events spinning out of control. ValueJet Airlines resumes flying today. The low-cost carrier shut down in June after a crash in the Florida Everglades that killed all 110 people on board. The federal government approved ValueJet's return last week. From member station WABE, Joshua Leves reports.
A ValueJet DC-9 jet will take off from Atlanta shortly after noon today, heading for Washington's Dulles Airport. The flight is the first in what ValueJet calls Phase 1 of its return. ValueJet is also beginning service to three Florida cities. Through October 3rd, all fares will be $19. Some leaders of the Flight Attendants Union are fighting for a court order to keep ValueJet grounded. They claim the company's leaders don't care enough about safety. Still, ValueJet has booked mostly sold-out flights for its 15 aircraft. Now Delta and Kiwi Airlines say they'll match ValueJet's introductory fares. For National Public Radio, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
The government says consumer spending rose 0.6% last month. Personal income rose by almost the same amount. Meanwhile, the Commerce Department reported today that sales of new homes in August were running at the strongest pace in more than a decade. Sales increased 4.7%. Stock prices are higher at this hour on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up more than 29 points at 5902.14. You're listening to National Public Radio News. Dr. Jack Kevorkian attended his 41st known suicide yesterday. From member station WDET in Detroit, Lori Pyunk reports.
Kevorkian took the body of 71-year-old Dr. Richard Faw of North Carolina to a hospital in Royal Oak, Michigan. Kevorkian's attorney, Jeffrey Feiger, says the psychiatrist had colon cancer and was in extreme pain. Faw's death was the first Kevorkian is known to have attended since the death of Isabel Correa of California, September 7th. Police and prosecutors say they're continuing to examine evidence seized September 6th in a raid in an Oakland County motel where Kevorkian was meeting with Correa. Feiger has filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court against the Bloomfield Police Department and two prosecutors seeking $25 million in damages. Feiger contends police violated the civil rights of Kevorkian and Correa during the raid. For National Public Radio, this is Lori Pyunk in Detroit.
A newspaper in Alabama reports today that newly declassified military logs show U.S. commanders told troops during the Persian Gulf War to ignore reports of low-level concentrations of nerve gas agents in the air. But the Birmingham Reporter says the commanders sealed their facilities with airlocks and put filters on their ventilation system. The reports of nerve gas contamination reportedly came from Czech intelligence sources. More than 20,000 veterans have complained of illness since returning from the Gulf. Many believe it's linked to low-level exposure to chemical warfare agents. A Nation of Islam lawyer is planning a class-action lawsuit charging the CIA deliberately introduced crack cocaine into black communities. Arif Muhammad is urging blacks to make a list of people who've been adversely affected by crack. The San Jose Mercury News reported last month that the Central Intelligence Agency allegedly sold tons of crack cocaine to street gangs in Los Angeles to fund guerrilla armies in Nicaragua. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Jerry Gross. Chicago Bulls coach Phil Jackson is getting ready for the new season. It will be hard to top the last one. In June, the Bulls won their fourth NBA championship in 6 years. Jackson coaches one of the greatest players in the history of the game, Michael Jordan, and perhaps the most flamboyant player, Dennis Rodman. Coach Phil Jackson played with the New York Knicks for 11 years, beginning in 1967. He joined the coaching staff of the Bulls in 87 and became head coach in July of 89. In Jackson's memoir, Sacred Hoops, he describes his style of coaching, which includes meditation and other principles he's learned studying Zen Buddhism. Sacred Hoops will be published in paperback in early November. I asked Jackson about putting together last season's winning team. It was Rodman's first season with the Bulls. Michael Jordan had just returned to the Bulls in 95 after retiring from basketball and trying baseball, and the Bulls had to readjust to make room for him.
Scottie Pippen had moved into the leadership role as the team leader. He'd been a co-leader when Michael had been with the club, and I think many recognized the fact that he had emerged as a team leader. But with Michael gone, the burden really fell on Scottie's shoulders. And when Michael first left, we had eight players still remaining from the championship, the third championship we'd won in succession. So there was the continuity of that energy and the championship feeling. But the following season, the one Michael returned in March of that year, we only had three players from that original team that had played when Michael was gone. And so there was a real heavy burden on Scottie to be the leader, and he had assumed that burden and kind of made it his. He had stamped kind of an image of the leader of this team. And when Michael returned, there was kind of a shifting of nature and a shifting of tempo for the team to do to get him back in the lineup.
Were the players not used to playing with somebody who was such the star?
There was that. There was the watch, the myth, Michael Jordan play basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had this timing. Michael is a player who likes to size up the opponent. And in our offense, it's kind of a tempo. We like to play at a certain rhythm. And with the rhythm that we developed without Michael, it had been kind of a 4-4 beat or count that we call kind of a just a rhythm beat that you play at. And if you can't get rid of the ball after a two count or on the third count, you're hurting your offensive teammates. Michael likes to size up the defense to see where he can go one-on-one or beat the defense. And a lot of times these guys were still operating inside their offense and running into Michael's space or expecting a pass and not receiving it with the same timing they were receiving before, while Michael was sizing up his opportunities. Given the training camp that we had last year in our championship year, we learned that timing. These guys relearned the timing that Michael plays in, and they were able to adopt themselves to that timing.
Now, you traded for Dennis Rodman, which in a lot of ways I think was a really surprising decision. As you've said, Rodman's makeup smacks of everything your team tries to avoid: individualistic behavior versus a team orientation, unreliable behavior versus professionalism in the game. Did you think it would be worth it to get his great skills as a rebounder, but also inherit his unpredictability in behavior?
Well, Terry, this is one of the enigmas of life, of course, is that this team had to, the Bulls, as an inception young team as champions in the NBA, had to beat a team that Dennis Rodman was on, in which everything that was generated towards winning the championship had to be directed against the manifestation of what Dennis Rodman plays at, the intensity, the kind of anger, the individualism, the irrational kind of physical nature that Dennis kind of carries on the floor. So when the proposition was leveled that of all the options that we had to make our team a possible championship contender, Dennis was the only one that really provided the best risk and reward, even though there were four or five others on the table. I had to be faced with the interview of having Dennis sit face-to-face and talk to him about his abilities to play as a team player. Was he willing to go back to playing whatever role was necessary, as he had done with the Pistons in the 80s, now that he would come to the Bulls in 95-96 season? And I had to have that assurances before I would incorporate him, and I had many doubts, and was even concerned about it into the month of December, as to whether Dennis could incorporate himself into the team. But he was able to do that, and I found a very warm kind of person that was really a team player that we got as by great fortune.
You know, in the epilogue for your forthcoming paperback edition of your book, you describe your first meeting with Dennis Rodman. And he's sitting there in his chair, and he doesn't take off his sunglasses when he meets you. He doesn't stand up to shake your hand. Isn't that a sign of disrespect? How did you deal with that?
Well, it is, Terry, a sign of disrespect, but it's also kind of a juvenile behavior. You know, it might be shyness underneath all that. So Dennis and I had many occasions of bumping up against each other in play versus Detroit. And also I coached an all-star game in which Dennis had been a member. He was on the East team that I had coached, but he hadn't spoken a word the whole time he was there, except if you addressed him and talked to Dennis. And I found that Dennis had to be addressed personally before he would offer any part of the conversation. So I knew that if I was direct with him, I would get a response. And I walked over to him and grabbed his hand and said, "Dennis, I know you stand up when you meet people that like you or you have respect for." And I kind of pulled him to his feet. And he smiled, just gave a little bit of a smile, but he was shy. And I know from being around him that he's a very shy person initially.
What was your approach to telling him that there was certain behavior that was going to be expected or demanded of him that might go against his nature in some ways?
You know, I just had to be really direct and, you know, say, you know, there are rules. We have rules like any other society that we have to have met. And if you bump up against them all the time, then you're going to be consistently being, you know, on the edge of either being fined or being in behavior that is going to go against the grain of our society. So you've got to find a way. Well, you know, the first day we have our center court meeting and, everybody's ready to practice, shoes tied, practice jerseys on, all set up in the middle of the floor. Dennis comes out, the shirt is around his neck, but he doesn't have his arms through the holes and his shoes aren't tied, you know. So I found that Dennis would have a little behavior problem every day that generally, you know, you'd either have to smile at him or say, "Come on, get it together." because it's just his behavior mode. He's not going to be part of the group. He doesn't want to be a stamp addition of the next Bulls. He wants to be an individual so desperately. But he found that I was willing to give him that little space. In fact, I called him a heyoka, which he loved, because that's a Sioux term for a backward walking or a person of different orientation, and he definitely is that.
So you let him have his stylistic individuality and those quirks, but you wouldn't let him be too individualistic on the team. I mean, in other words, on the team he had to be with the team, but in his personal style, whatever.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, I really believe in that free expression. And I think that the more space you give players and the more space you give people, a lot of times, as long as they know what the parameters are they can move in, the more freedom they have. It's kind of an approach that I even have towards meditation, that if you cramp yourself into a space, especially when you meditate, you can drive yourself completely wacko. But if you give yourself a large space in which to operate.
Mental space you're talking about.
Yes. And you do the same thing. I found it works very well with players that I've worked with, at least. They like the space and freedom, but yet there's a general parameter in which they have to deal with. And we have a very strict and kind of rigid system of offense that we operate with, which requires you to pass the ball and requires team play. A lot stricter than, say, a lot of teams that may have stricter rules, but perhaps less individualism in its own right.
Phil Jackson is my guest, the winning coach of the Chicago Bulls. He has a book called Sacred Hoops, Spiritual Lessons of a Hardwood Warrior, and that's about to come out in paperback. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Phil Jackson is my guest, the winning coach of the Chicago Bulls. His book, Sacred Hoops, is about to come out in paperback. What was your approach to getting Rodman, Jordan, and Pippen to work together when Rodman joined the team?
You know, I never had one doubt that he would have a difficult time doing that. I asked him one question about, you know, you've always played the non-offensive player. You don't like offense. You don't claim to like to score and all that. But, you know, I want to know if you're a team player. Can you pass? Can you be part of a functioning offense that will rely upon you to be in a certain position at a certain time instead of just always being at the backboard trying to rebound or always being out of position? And his first statement was, I know how to pass the ball to Michael Jordan, and I know that I can be a real good passer and feeder to him. And I said, well, that's nice, but it's not the most important thing. The important thing is to hit the guy who's open. And our offense and the rules in which I've been talking about, that large parameter, requires guys to be team players, that you hit the first guy that's open. It's kind of a prerequisite. It doesn't mean you hit number 23 as opposed to 33 or 13, whoever is your teammate. You hit the first guy that's open in the sequence of actions that demand it. So I felt like, yay, this is going to happen. If he wants to play ball and he says he can play ball, everybody will work together. However, you know, the first thing Dennis does when he gets to the ball club, he says, you know, I have no regrets about, you know, what happened with Scottie Pippen 5 or 6 years ago in the championship. It's a headbutting incident or whatever else happened. That he wasn't going to apologize for his behavior back then when he's with so-called Detroit Bad Boys. But the interesting thing was in Grant Park at the championship rally, all's done and championships won. You know, Dennis took the opportunity in front of 400,000 fans to turn to Scotty and say, I've been waiting all year. You've really embraced me as a team player, and I do want to apologize for those incidents back then, which was, I thought, very gracious.
Speaking of headbutting, in March, Dennis Rodman was suspended for headbutting an official after what Rodman perceived was a bad call. What did you say to him afterwards? He got suspended. He was fined $200,000. What did you say to Rodman afterwards?
Well, Dennis had gone, you know, in the locker room and had exacerbated the situation by coming out into the runway and trying to address the head of the officials, you know, Rod Thorne, who was in the stands watching the game and wanted to make an issue of it right then. And then after the game, in post-game interviews, had taken a very forceful, an antagonistic attitude towards the league. Oh, Stern can do this and Thorne can do that. If they want to suspend me, they can, attitude. But it was just his reaction to the disappointment of what had happened to the situation. So I kind of let him stew for a day and then called him the next morning into my room. We were on the road in Philadelphia, as a matter of fact, and had a talk with him about responsibility to the team and about his responsibility as a player, and that we really needed him as a player. And I felt it was partially my fault. Scottie Pippen wasn't with us that particular day. We'd also had Luke Longley out with a knee operation, who had just returned to our lineup. And I had said to the other starters on the team, to Harper and to Jordan and to Dennis, you guys have to step up your game a little bit tonight because we're without Scottie and Luke's just back. And I just put a little bit of extra edge in the game. And Dennis doesn't need that. He already carries it. And he took the extra edge and put it out on the floor. And he doesn't need any more incentive to play hard. He plays at a level that's above that anyway. So from that regard, I learned a lesson that you don't have to prime the pump with Dennis. You have to back him down a little bit.
Bema has been pretty angry when his own behavior got him suspended for 6 games when you really needed him on the court. Mm-hmm.
I really wasn't angry at him. I told him I was disappointed because I thought we were going to be able to make it through the season. But I was in a way relieved because it alleviated a problem that everybody had been saying all year long. Oh, it's going to happen. Dennis Rodman's going off. He's a loose cannon. He's going to bring the Bulls down like he'd brought down the San Antonio Spurs. And I felt that, Dennis felt that building. There had been a story, a couple television interviews have been following the team, and there was just a buildup of tension that was going around it. And I think Dennis had a few personal things in his life that also created that. And so if it was going to happen in the playoffs, I'd rather have it happen at a regular season level and eliminate the fact that, hey, you can regulate this, we can get it straightened out now. And in the playoffs, maybe we can alleviate the tension that builds because of the greater intensity of focus and the intensity that the media world brings to our team. This is one of the things I talked to Dennis about, how much attention the Bulls mm-hmm. have and how much more he has to regulate his behavior. So anyway, we talked to him a little bit about, urge control cessation, taking urges out of his, even though the desire is there, how does he create that? And I thought Dennis did a real good job. We had some therapy and some therapists come in and talk to him. Dennis was willing to discuss it and was open about facing the problem head on. And I thought that was really the key, is that he, then admitted that, yes, I did it. I was could have been the culprit, could have been picked on, but it's my responsibility. And as a response to his teammates, he sent a dozen roses to all 14 of the players, which was an expense that I thought was well worth it because everybody appreciated the effort, at least the extension that Dennis said, hey, I let you guys down. Here's something I want you to remember.
When you started playing with the Knicks, you were sometimes called, the hippie or the flower child of the team. I think your hair was long for the time in sports. Mm-hmm. So do you identify in any way with his dress? And I wonder if you had any experience that you think you if you had any experiences as a player that you now draw on as a coach when it comes to personal style.
Well, yes. There's the individualism that I know I felt as a player. I had a beard, and I liked to wear jeans and work shirts. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the proletariat, kind of rebellious style of the day in my generation. But I was part of my culture, my age group. I don't see a lot of kids out there like Dennis, although he's creating a lot of kids that are trying to be like him. So he is so unique and so outrageous that it's not what I was struggling for. It was like a revolutionary statement in our age group against the establishment. But for Dennis, it's more of an individualistic statement that, hey, I'm an individual. This is an entertainment facet of basketball. And from that standpoint, I can allow that and agree with it. And I respect his individualism. There are times when it just presses the line a little bit. And, mm-hmm. We have yet to to cross over. He's had an idea of when enough's enough, so that I feel comfortable enough with the fact that, hey, Dennis, you know, we're going to a nice place, you know. When we come into the Four Seasons, you know, look like you're part of the clientele, please, you know.
Now, you have two of the biggest stars in basketball on your team, Michael Jordan and Dennis Rodman. You are very well known in sports for applying the principles of Zen Buddhism to your coaching. Now, Zen is about transcending ego, about going beyond ego. And being a sports star is kind of about having a big ego. I mean, it's hard to not have a big ego when you're a sports star and you're making a lot of money and the press is dying to get at you and women are throwing themselves at you. How, from a Zen perspective, do you deal with the ego of your biggest stars?
Well, you know, I think what has to be held up from the standpoint of being a coach, and especially one that's trying to be at some level conscious and aware, is a mirror. And to hold a mirror up in front of people is probably the best recognition that they can have as mirroring back to themselves what their image is. So there are subtle little things that I think are available to a coach or to a person in my position that keep or help keep a person of that level grounded. Some of them are privacy, you know, really trying to keep it as private as possible so that we can, you know, be ourselves, let our hair down, not let our so-called image or our personality be the force of who we are, but be the real person in the real moment. There's a lot of things that go into talking about the team as to who they are as personnel on the floor, what their inadequacies are and what their strengths are. There's videotape that we use as a crutch and a tool a lot of time in which you can do so many variety of things that constantly bring about the aspects and the facets of the media and television and commercials, all of which play at the same time that our games usually play on TV, which are real good tools to use. So there are a variety of mirrors to hold up.
I don't understand. How are you using like commercials and other programs as tools?
Well, you know, it's very, very easy to use a, you know, you're videotaping a game, you're showing this team the replay of the game that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And you can throw in a couple messages. You can use a commercial of Michael Jordan or Dennis Rodman or Scottie Pippen, three guys that we have on our team that do a lot of commercials, following a play in which they're involved in which they're doing something that exhibits perhaps not the character that they're demonstrating on TV or enforcing the character or the image that they have on TV. Without mentioning products, it's pretty obvious that there are a lot of them out there in which, you know, you can use. So it's a lot of fun to use, especially Michael and that with the guru that's sitting there and they're drinking Gatorade, if I get the right commercial right. And he meets this this guru after climbing and running this mountain to this very spiritual-looking guy. So they're all those images that I like to incorporate into videotapes that are a lot of fun for me and for the guys that are in the team, because it's pretty much a basketball team is a group of guys that can let their hair down and see each other for their strengths and their weaknesses. And when they recognize the weaknesses that they each have, then they become a good team. And so coach's responsibility is to constantly hold that mirror up, and that's my job.
Phil Jackson is the coach of this year's NBA champions, the Chicago Bulls. His memoir, Sacred Hoops, will be published in paperback in early November. Jackson will be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, when winning isn't everything, we continue our conversation with Chicago Bulls coach Phil Jackson. He says he teaches his team that there's more to playing than winning, but he's not complaining about their status as NBA champions. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Kate and Anna McGarrigle. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Phil Jackson, head coach of the Chicago Bulls. In June, he led the team to their fourth championship in 6 years. Jackson's memoir, Sacred Hoops, which will be published in paperback in early November, describes his approach to coaching, which includes meditation and other principles he's learned studying Zen Buddhism. Zen Buddhism is all about transcending the ego, whereas star athletes are known for their inflated egos. We talked about how he deals with that paradox. Do you ever say, go meditate and realize that you're more important than your ego, that you must put your ego in? You know, I mean, do you tell them, do you try to use the principles that you follow of meditation and Zen Buddhism to try to get them to just get rid of some of that ego?
There's no doubt that we try to teach them the tool, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's real important that, you know, you carry some of your belief to the marketplace with you when you go out there. And that's something that you can't sit on or hide. So, you know, I have a professional person that comes in that I really respect that can come in and teach what we call mindfulness or focusing without using the term meditation, because it may carry some weight to mm-hmm. the term. Mm-hmm. And we talk about its values that to play, its values to relieving stress, and we talk about how we can do it. We practice it as a group, but we, you know, it's not something we daily come to practice and sit on our cushions and meditate. You know, this is something that I think is where you open the door, or maybe give them the key and say, "Here, it's yours to use if you want to use it," because that's as far as I want to go as a coach. I don't want to, you know, be forceful or controlling, but, you know, allow that freedom. But there's other things, you know, we'd like to teach yoga. We'd like to have, you know, a Tai Chi instructor. You know, I mean, there's other things that we'd like to have, but when you only have so much time, we think that being focused, mindful, mm-hmm. is maybe one of the most important things that we can teach or can give them as a tool. So that's one of the things we talk about. Then we sit down, and when we're going to do something that requires this mindfulness that's incorporated in our work, then we can talk about it as a group. How connected are we so that we have mindful behavior, or that we're really, working from an awareness level as to how we perform or what kind of level we're performing at under stress, even in very games of great magnitude. So it's a tool that is used not only for a personal level, but it's also used at a level to help make the team a better team, I think. So that's why I've incorporated.
You said that you try to get players to connect with something larger than themselves. How do you do that?
Well, I do it in whatever way is a cause that's greater than, say, well, let's win the NBA championship. We want to win the NBA championship, and we want to have a great contract, and we want to have material goods bestowed upon us. Those are things that are all so ephemeral material that to me it's got to be something that's bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's every year I just think of different challenges. Last year, we had kind of this motto that the journey is the reward. That the reality of working day by day, practice, if it's a practice day, a game, if it's a game day, and the journey of doing this thing day in and day out is in itself the reward, and it was, because we won 72 games last season, which was an incredible feat for a team that plays 82 game schedule, to do that day in and day out.
Do you have a sense of how much of your success comes from this approach to coaching, where you're applying certain spiritual principles and so on? How much of your success comes from that, and how much of it is just much more practical things about calling plays and analyzing strengths and weaknesses?
Well, I'm trying to paraphrase Yogi Berra's comment about,
yeah.
90% of it's mental and the other half of it's physical or something like that.
right.
Well, 90% of it's mental and the other 50% of it's physical. The reality is that you've got to have the athletes and the players that can do this. There's no substitute for the talent, and that you have to have talented people. Yeah. Credit goes to Michael Jordan, to Scottie Pippen, to Dennis Rodman. That they have the talent that can do what they have to do. The jollies that I get from doing this spiritual or goal-seeking at a higher level is just, I tell them, you're just appeasing your coach and you're letting me have my fun, so that they have an idea that they're letting me have some fun while they're doing the game playing. They get all the fun playing the games. I get some fun playing mind games.
Professional sports is so much about money and power and, of course, winning. And those are things that don't seem that compatible with Zen Buddhism and meditation and spiritual values and so on. How do you deal? I mean, when you lose, how do you deal with that? And why is winning very important if you're trying to be in a more spiritual plane that's not about ego and so on? How do you correlate all of that in your mind?
Well, there's a lot of times we come in and we win what we call win ugly. And I don't like to use that phrase. It's just that we didn't do as good a job as we perhaps could do. And there's still lessons to be learned, but we always think there are a lot of lessons.
That means you won, but you made real blunders even though you won?
Yes, it wasn't a pleasing game. Mm-hmm. We're trying to play a game at a level in which people will remember how we play basketball. That's one of the goals that I say that, it's one of these type of things that let's have something beyond just, hey, we won, and that's it. Let's do it in a style or a way that's remarkable. That's inspiring to people, because we have that ability. We should play at that level. And there's some games that you come in and you lose, and you feel pretty good about losing. It was still a great battle. It was still a wonderful night, and you can still benefit from something that you've had that hasn't been a win. And there's some nights a win may feel just as bad as a loss. And so we don't always say that it's measured by wins and losses, but it's measured by how you play.
Did you always feel that way?
No, I don't think so. I think winning was the all-important driving motivation for me as a younger person.
And when did that change? Why did that change?
It changed somewhere in my professional career. When professional ball became a continuation of a very long season of 82 games, and I came to a basketball club that was struggling and suddenly became very good in the New York Knicks for a 7-year period of time. And during that period of time, the enjoyability of winning and the focus on how to do that became more important than just on winning, as it was when I was a rookie and this was the Knicks were a struggling team. And if you could just win a game, it was the most important thing that you could do.
What are your pep talks like before games?
Well, first of all, they're very low-keyed, and they're not pep talks. I wouldn't put them in those. It's a matter of bringing to focus what the group has to focus on. And so it may be on energy. It may be on developing enough energy for the game, but more or less it's on, what we can do that strengthens us as opposed to what we can do that can take away from the opponent's ability to operate at full strength. And so it's just trying to bring key points out to a group. I have the oldest team, they tell me, in the NBA, average age over, 30. And they have probably heard every pep talk possible by the time they're 25.
Mm-hmm.
And so pep talks are usually going to leave them deflated. And, they bring their own energy to it. So what we'd like to do is bring focus. A lot of times it's just a moment of quietness, and sometimes it's a 2 or 3 minutes. So let's just be still and quiet before this game and get ourselves thinking on one as a one-man unit or a one team, have a mind of one. So just so that we can get in stride together, because it's been disjointed, we may have a hard travel schedule, the media may have been busting their seams to try and get into our locker room and have stayed too long, and we just need to focus. But for the most part, the players that are the premier players have great focusing ability, great concentration skills, and to bring everybody to that level is always important.
When you were playing with the Knicks, what worked for you best before a game, and what were some of the things your coach, Red Holtzman, would do?
Well, Red was very constant. He used to say almost the same thing before every game, and his speeches were probably at most 2 to 3 minutes. And at some point during the talk, he'd usually say, if you guys have any trouble concentrating, just nod your head so at least I think that you're focusing on what I'm saying. Or if you have to prop your eyelids open with toothpicks, don't mind me, I'll watch you do it. And he would joke about it himself, that he was saying the same thing. But what he was trying to do was trying to get us in the same kind of focused mood and concentrating on the same activity. For me, what worked best of all was to stretch and to be quiet before a ball game. That was the things that I enjoyed doing.
My guest is Phil Jackson, head coach of the Chicago Bulls. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Phil Jackson is my guest, the winning coach of the Chicago Bulls, and author of the book Sacred Hoops, Spiritual Lessons of a Hardwood Warrior, and that's about to come out in paperback. How were you first introduced to Zen Buddhism, and how did you start incorporating that into the game?
Well, I had a brother that was a college student, graduate student, and he picked me up at a baseball game I was playing in North Dakota. I was a senior in high school, and drove me from Bismarck, North Dakota, back to Williston. And in that very late night drive was telling me about some very exciting things that were happening in his life, and among them were the introduction to Zen Buddhism. It kind of opened my mind to a new format. I was raised a fundamentalist Christian. In the process, I started searching a little bit on my own and, ended up as religion as one of my minors. I had a composite major, actually. One of my majors in college was religion. And I kept exploring until really I kind of found a group that I could sit with in the early 70s.
And that connected to the game for you right away, or did it take a while?
Well, it really did. I was disconnected from the game. Actually, you know, it was so opposed, athletics was so opposed to my spiritual life that it was kind of a schizophrenic life for me. I could play sports over here in the very world, or I could be over here wholly in the very spiritual world in church and in the community that I was born and raised in. And the two supposedly didn't meet, and as a consequence, I think that's one of the reasons I loved athletics so much, was to get away from all this religion. And then the process of finding out that, you know, really it goes with you everywhere, when I was a little bit older, I could realize that, you know, this was something that you carry with you. You don't have to carry it on your shoulder as a chip, but you can carry it in your heart.
Your father was a minister. What were your parents' reactions to you pursuing sports professionally?
Well, my mother was a high school basketball player.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, she was a high school basketball player and a letter winner, and I often wore a sweater when I was a little kid, you know. And she liked to come out and shoot hoops, and there was some competitive, a great competitive level that she had. And so basketball was really kind of an accepted format in our family as a game, although I liked all the sports of football and baseball too. But it, as long as it didn't interfere with church, it was okay. And we had Friday night meetings in our church, and my brother, who was an older athlete, 6 years older than I was not allowed to participate in athletics because they had Friday night games in the high school basketball team. So that was a real conflict. When we moved to a new church in out of the state of Montana to the state of North Dakota, they didn't have those Friday night services. They had Wednesday and Thursday night church services to go along with their Sunday services. And so the Friday and Saturday ball games did not interfere, and it was okay. And so I was fortunate.
Did you ever go wild after leaving the more regimented life of your parents?
No. I don't think in that regard, never went wild. I did explore and was, I think, a person that liked to try different experiences, but I'm not one that went wild.
I want to paraphrase something that Dennis Rodman says in his best-selling book. He says, you know, in the NBA, off the court, 50% of life is sex and the other 50% is money. How do you deal with it, watching some of your players get really caught up in that off-the-court life of sex and money? You come from a much more, like, from a very disciplined background, and you're very disciplined as a coach as well. You have a spiritual side to help you and to fall back on. So what do you take a part in their private lives off the court, the part that might have to do with sex and money?
Well, you know, that's right there. That's a level sometimes of some of the people that, you know, have to live in this world of athletics. It is, and most people assume that that's really where athletics lives at, that level, but that's not so. I think athletics lives at all those levels, from the conscious to the, you know, the very mundane and the very earthy areas of our psyche. And, you know, from this standpoint, I'm able to do some things that are kind of fun with the team. You know, there's this kind of a collection of people that know that I give books out to the ball players. And we have a long road trip at the early part of the season after usually a weekend of the year in November. We usually take off on a road trip for 2 weeks, covers Thanksgiving. And during this period of time, I give them books in which, you know, I make a little attempt to try and, you know, move them along on this path, you know. And one of the things I picked up from one of my teammates, Senator Bill Bradley, was that, you know, there's people want to move up. People want to be more conscious. And, you know, just from my association with him and, you know, maybe going to art museums here, some things that, you know, I wasn't really associated with when I was a young man, and learning, you know, some kind of things that were culture or taste oriented, I found myself intrigued by them. And I feel that other players, and professional players particularly, want to prove their life. They want to be educated. They go to college. A lot of them don't get through college. Some of them still want that education even when they come to the NBA. And I like to help push that along or move that in a direction they like to go.
Could you mention any of the books that you've given out?
Well, you know, one of the players I gave Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance to was John Paxson, one of our great players in the past. And at the other end of the spectrum, you know, I gave Beavis and Butthead to, you know, Stacey King, who loves cartoons and loves television.
Have you had to deal with players who grew up poor and now have big money and don't necessarily know how to handle it?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, that's quite obvious that the younger players in our league, regardless, you know, have never had this kind of money, and no one would, regardless of whether you've grown up in an affluent family or not, suddenly have $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $1 million at your disposal is, you know, ridiculous to think about. So there's a process that goes through the NBA of young players come out of college, and the first year they buy their toys, and the second year they buy their cars, and the third year they're doing other things with their money. And it usually takes a 2 or 3 year period of time for these players to realize that all the material growth and wealth and everything else that they have has not brought them any happiness. It's brought them diversion, it's brought them some, you know, comfort, but it really hasn't brought them the kind of happiness. And they're starting to get back and think about the fact that, hey, you know, this is a career, I better be a professional, and all this has just made me want maybe to explore life a little bit deeper. And so I think that there's an awareness level that comes to players at 26, 27 when they come to the NBA, and that's one of the reasons why we're happy to have the oldest team in the NBA and not the youngest.
Well, there's a downside, of course, of the oldest team, which is that the body's a little less flexible. People start performing at a little less than their peak. How are you dealing with that? And members of your team are now a year older than they were last year.
Well, that's a good question, because that's our opponent. Our enemy is ourself, really, and if we can prepare ourselves for that, we'll be fine. We do have a great program in weights and conditioning, and we dedicate a part of our practice to that. It's not just banging heads and running up and down the court and shooting jump shots. A lot of it is physically keeping ourselves prepared and ready with massage therapists, with with stretching, with weights and conditioning. We really put a lot of energy into the maintenance, nutrition, those type of things. And then I'm a coach that has, instead of two-day practices, like a lot of training camps open with practice both in the morning and the evening, and the guys run 4 or 5 hours a day, we have one practice. And that one practice, even in itself, is still only, you know, a couple hours long. So it's not a teaching old dog, new tricks to old dogs. It's the fact that let's maintain this body and what we have and bring it along to a point where we can sustain it.
After the Bulls won their championship, you signed a new contract. It's a year-long contract. A year is not very long. Any any guesses what will be next for you?
You know, I would like to have a grand scheme of things and a plan in life.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, it would just be so great. But I just want to have a really wonderful year this year and enjoy it. I have twin boys that are seniors in high school here in Illinois. And that was really a goal, is, you know, to finish it out a little bit and to come back and coach these special people for one more year. We have all 12 players back again. And after this year's over, I'm going to take a big sigh and sit back a little bit and see what else is on the menu and what else maybe I can do. It may still be basketball, but right now I'm going to leave those options open.
Phil Jackson, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry. I've listened to so many programs. It's really been a pleasure to be part of one.
Phil Jackson is head coach of the Chicago Bulls. His memoir, Sacred Hoops, will be published in paperback in early November. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new recording by the McGarrigles. This is Fresh Air.
Kate and Anna McGarrigal have just released their first new album in 6 years. It's called Matapédia, named after a river that runs through the part of eastern Quebec where the sisters grew up. Since 1976, the McGarrigals have released a series of recordings that have earned them a devoted cult following, and their songs have been covered by such performers as Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review of Matapédia.
There's a freezing rain warning, gale force winds forecast. I need shelter until the morning, or until this weather is past. Hang on, your little heart.
Twenty years after their first release, Kate and Anna McGarrigal continue to be popular music's most playful misanthropes, writing songs about their pleasures and their dissatisfactions, singing them with witty tartness. If red wine vinegar was music, this is how it would sound. That song, called I Don't Know, is written by Kate McGarrigal, and it compares love to a, quote, bullet in a gun aimed at your heart. In itself, that's not a particularly original metaphor, but then Kate's the one who in the past came up with a heart like a wheel and life as a jigsaw puzzle. No, it's the follow-up to the initial image that gives the song its quiet power. Rather than just let that bullet image stand alone, she goes on to describe love as something that tears at your heart, that makes you scream and bleed and fall down on your knees. Murmuring that man is truly the cruelest of beasts, you know that she's not referring to mankind, but to the way some specific men have treated her and her sister. And all of this is framed by such a beautiful, soft melody.
You ask me what it's all about. I say I don't know. Should you stay?
Despite the frequent vehemence of their emotions, I've never been so dumb as to think that Kate and Anna are mere man-haters. And anyway, Kate used to be married to Loudon Wainwright, whose own songs depict him as the sort of cad any woman would merely be sane for hating. For comic purposes, the McGarrigals, in their onstage between-song patter, like to depict themselves as chilly Quebec spinsters sitting at home sipping tea and tapping at piano keys. Virginia Wolves with icicles. But the warmth of their music and the precision of their lyrics lets out the truth. They're really self-reliant romantics, maybe looking for love in all the wrong places, but wise enough to be amused by their own folly.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Matapédia by Kate and Anna McGarrigal. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Joan Tuohy. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Shock and she'll work at the mill that stands beside the river. Could be Lowell, could be Lawrence, or Nashua, New Hampshire. They've left the mill to cut down trees in winter. Little Ellen, who's only 10, she knits and spins, sits and folds in darkness and in hunger in the cold mill by the frozen water. And Saint Jean-Baptiste says it's okay. Come pray to me on Sunday. We'll cash your notes, we'll cast your votes. Just bring me some of that.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.